Charlie's all around me, man. Can you see Charlie? What do I do?
He's in the bushes, man.
Is he in the bushes?
Yep.
I don't. Oh, no. I'm scared. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode. We're going into the heart of darkness today with Apocalypse Now Redux.
We are plunging deep up the river.
Going up through the river, and it's going to get weird. It's going to get a little bit dark. It's going to get a little bit messy.
We will be getting off the boat at multiple points.
At multiple points, and we'll go get sidetracked by some bunnies, and we'll get chased by a tiger. There's even a bit of time for surfing.
Yes, there's always time for surfing.
Yes, Apocalypse Now. What? Yeah. Before we actually get into it, how have you been anyway, Jock? It's been a month since we've... been roughly a month. It was my birthday yesterday, so...
Oh, I've been the same as I've always been, really, Rowan. Just keeping alive.
Alive? Just
doing nothing productive.
Doing nothing practical, but uni's starting
well,
on Monday.
On Monday, yep.
Yeah, so I'm going to get so learnt. I'm going to get so educated. Yep. Like, I'm just going to get those HDs and the teacher's going to be like, damn, boy. User smart.
Yeah, we are going to tear the academic world apart.
just smash it apart. So, it's so funny. Like, we started reviewing this movie, right? And just recently, I tried to apply for the ADF, the Australian Defence Force. And apparently, I got knocked back because I was a little bit emotional.
A little bit insane in the membrane.
And then having watched Apocalypse Now... I was thinking, why wouldn't they want someone like me?
Why do they want sane people in the military?
Why do you want to break people? Like, don't you just want broken people in the military already? Yeah. And then, so...
You want to start off with Captain Willis.
I want to start off as Captain Willis. Instead of working someone to the bone so they're tracking snails and razor blades, why not just already have someone do that, you know? So...
Just make them be the snail and the razor blade.
Just be the snail crawling across, the razor blade. So, but yeah, I was a little bit bummed by that. They said I can apply next year, so I'm going to apply next year, but I'm just going to walk straight into the ADF with my snails on a razor blade, just saying, doing my smile.
In my nightmare, I am a slug. Crawling along the edge of a straight razor.
Okay, I'm just going to go in. I'm going to do my best Marlon Brando impersonation. That's what's going to get me fired. I did
the horror. The horror.
But, yeah, so that was my thing. And it was weird. I don't know. I think I'd make a really good, crazy person just hanging out in the woods. Like, I reckon I would have the full-on potential to take over, a little tribe and play God. Like, I'm really up for that.
You could create the apocalypse now.
Oh, man, I would.
I can actually see you being a bit of a cult leader.
Yeah, I would love to be a cult leader.
I think we had this plan with JJ once, didn't we? We were going to move out to the middle of the forest.
Yeah, we're going to move out to the forest and... Access.
You were going to be the leader. I was going to be like the wizard.
Oh, you could be like the journalist.
Yeah, man. His mind just works in mysterious ways.
It just works in mysterious ways. I just can't understand it, but he can understand it. He can understand it all. Well, but that's odd because I'm the journalist out of us. Well, potential journalist. So
that could be conflicting.
Maybe you should be the cult leader. I don't know, we should do a Facebook poll, who would be the best, cult leader?
Yeah, actually, I think perhaps I would probably win.
Okay, well, what credentials do you have to be a cult leader?
I don't know, I'm probably slightly insane, magical thinking, stuff like that.
Okay, well, what type of magical thinking have we got here? Like we've got to really figure out how to market this, cult leader potential inside your head.
Well, I do believe in the coming collapse of Western capitalism.
Okay, yep, that's a good...
Fervently. So that's like one tick in the box of the cult leader list.
Yeah, okay, the downfall of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I do have some paranormal beliefs.
We
have discussed this at length.
Yes. Like, you could mold that.
I'm so disappointed that that Ouija board never worked.
Yeah, but I think we needed an update, you know. So the problem with Ouija boards, especially in today, it's all digital.
Yeah.
It's all none of this analog stuff. Like, when you're speaking to paranormal realms, like, you need an analog. You need an analog way, you know. Like, you don't.
Yeah, we need to get up with the times of the paranormal world.
Yeah. The paranormal world hasn't got, like, bloody Microsoft 10. You know, they're still running off bloody 98, for God's sakes.
Yeah, we need to make, like a paranormal pitch to the
celestial
plane.
We should just do, like, a quick trip up to heaven somehow and just say, yep, we have a deal for you, and go full on madman about it.
Have you heard of this great thing called iMessage?
Oh, bam. Yeah. And all Pegasus and, you know, Sisyphus and all those great gods will look at you and say, damn, this guy
he's got it sussed.
He's got it done. He's in.
It's our one-way ticket back to the mortal realm.
Yeah, well, we've got to make it, like, it's very inconvenient. Like, paranormal world, right? It's inconvenient to die.
Well, I mean,
that's what I'm saying.
like people aren't going to believe in, like, gods and stuff if, like, they do it the old-fashioned way and just, like, talk in your head, because you just think, oh, I'm going crazy. Yeah. But if God sends you a text...
Yeah. Then we mean business. Done. Bluetooth. Like, if God doesn't have Bluetooth, like, what is he, you know? He's just a Linux user.
Yeah, he's only dealing in the raw code.
Yeah, only in the raw code. And
nobody else can understand it.
Like, I was thinking the other day, like, if God was around today, like, the Ten Commandments would be on the tablet, you know? like, it would just be some nerd emerging from his cave, and he'd be like, hey, guys, I've got 10 new commandments, you know.
Yep.
A++ equals thou shalt not kill. And everyone will go, oh.
Okay, that's so boring, dude.
But where's the emoji? Where's the emoji? We need emojis. We need emojis for all the 10 commandments. So.
Do you think the 10 commandments would change in their structure a little bit? But maybe there'll be a...
Well, how would you
commandment
update?
Would be like, thou shalt not send drunk texts at 2 o'clock in the morning to your ex.
Well, that's why Apple has, like, the terms and conditions, you know, it's like 10 pages. Oh, my God, did you know on the Apple terms and conditions, I can't use iTunes for nuclear weapons?
Yeah,
I can't. It's actually in the
that's
form.
That's written in the
it's
form.
It's written in. You've got to do a bit of search for it, so I guarantee you can't use it for...
You're not allowed to purchase nuclear weapons on iTunes.
Or you can't use iTunes, like, to code, like, your nuclear weapons, grey plutonium, anything. Just imagine that. Like,
yeah.
If I had U2's bloody Songs of Innocence free album that I never asked for, I want to bomb myself.
So Steve Jobs' legal team was really thinking ahead there, weren't they?
Yeah, they really were. Like, last thing you want is just someone playing Taylor Swift while the country's just being annihilated. So. Oh, wow. So anyhow, we are talking about the heart of darkness that is Apocalypse Now today. And what were your initial thoughts of the movie Apocalypse Now? Did you enjoy it?
The first time I watched Apocalypse Now, I was quite young. I was about 13 years old, and I watched it with my dad and my godfather on our shitty little TV out in the back flat. And I didn't get it then. I was too young. Mm. But when I rewatched it later on in life, I think I was 16, then it really struck me that this is actually a great movie.
Yeah, because this time watching it, we had a bit of a build-up to watching it, because we came to a decision that it wasn't really a popcorn flick as such. I don't think I could enjoy this movie in a crowd.
Yes.
If that makes sense. Yeah. I really needed that time to close all the blinds, do a funky dance, smash a mirror.
Yeah.
You know, have dreams about napalm and just... watch it at my own expense.
I actually did that while I was watching it this time.
Did you really?
I got up on the couch. I was like,
did you have any funny substances while watching this?
No, I didn't actually. Oh, okay. I just drank a bit.
You just had a few drinks? Yeah. I watched this movie completely sober and I still felt messed up.
Yeah.
I felt high afterwards.
You don't really need drugs to watch Apocalypse Now, like, to be tripped out by this movie.
No, you don't. You know, it's just... It kind of reminds me of the new Blade Runner a bit. You've got to prepare yourself for a long ass movie and just sort of wrap yourself up in the sort of blanket of despair and depression. Yeah. You know, just enjoy the despair and depression and the depravity.
It's really, yeah, dense kind of storytelling. Mm. And there's, I think that's, you know, something in its favour. You know, it's a movie you can keep on coming back to and you find new things in it every time.
Yeah. I definitely found some new things on this viewing because...
Yeah, like on its surface, it looks pretty simple.
It is a simple narrative.
But when you actually try and watch it and, like, look at the details more, all this stuff starts coming out that you just never noticed.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I definitely had that viewing, and I'll go on to that on our second section of this podcast. But I just want to talk about some of the aesthetics in this movie that I just really... I watched it in HD on my TV, and the colour... The colour of the movie is just, like, it's real vibrant and orangey, and then it goes all dark towards the end. And from an artistic point of view, I really, really like that. I don't know if it was intentional by Francis Ford Coppola or...
It's just the way it panned out,
Just the way it panned out, but I really like it.
I definitely think it was intentional. Like, it's a... there was a lot of problems making this movie, but it paid off because it's a really a bit of a masterpiece of cinematography. Like, and it's way ahead of its time.
Mm. And I did, this was definitely, on this viewing, I definitely, because like you, I watched this movie when I was really young and I liked it, but I didn't get it. This time I actually finished watching it and I was like, that is actually a real masterpiece of a movie. Like, it's quite amazingly done, you know?
Especially in those end scenes, like, if you really think about it, the amount of effort they must have put into, like, getting this lighting just right so it only shines on half of Colonel Kurtz's face while he's talking and everything.
And you've got to think, like, this was before, like, movies like Fight Club and all that where they had, like, new sort of lighting arrangements where they had, like, balloons and all that, like... And
it was all done with practical effects.
And there was stuff
effects,
all sets
much,
as well. So, and the practical effects. Like that introduction scene where we meet, I can't remember his name, the general who wants his whole entire crewmen to go surfing. But the fact that there's like actual bombings and stuff going on and it's all done with real helicopters.
Yeah, and it's like, it's pretty amazing. Like, that is the kind of filmmaking that just wouldn't be allowed today. Like,
well, and it's even kind of...
Imagine if a filmmaker were to just, like, napalm a piece of Philippine forest to make a movie, like, the outrage about that.
Oh, no, the environment. It's like, no, it's for art. This is why we need to spend money on art, because we also help the military. But, no, you're right, like... And I was also thinking, like, with all those helicopters coming in, you know, to that classical piece of music...
Flight of the Valkyries. Yeah,
Flight of the Valkyries. It that would all be CGI today.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
None of that here, you know. There may have been like probably a few things painted, whatever, but very minimal, like sort of after effects going on.
Yeah, and you can. It really pays off in the movie because it just looks so visceral and real. Like,
real good and solid. Like, I think a problem with like CGI films these days, like there isn't that sort of solid connection between actors and like sets and all that. Like in this, like people are interacting, like there's sweat coming off their face, there's smoke going up people's nostrils, and they're looking uncomfortable, and that you just can't replicate. Those conditions, like, you can't CGI a heart attack.
It's really, replicating the fog of war. There.
Yeah, the fog of war theme, which we'll definitely go a little bit more into very shortly. Anyhow, we're going to play a quick trailer of the movie and then we're going to get into the philosophy in Plato's cave of Apocalypse Now Redux.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
I've been a soldier since I was 19, and I still haven't learned how to wait for it. I wanted a mission for my sins. They gave me one. Nobody had ever gone on a mission like it before. And when it was over, I'd never want another one.
Your mission is to proceed up the Nung River in a Navy patrol boat. Pick up Colonel Kurtz's path at Nu Mung Ba. When you find the Colonel, infiltrate his team by whatever means available, and terminate the Colonel's command.
Terminate with extreme prejudice.
My orders say I'm not supposed to know where I'm taking this boat, so I don't. But one look at you and I know it's gonna be hot.
Pick your boat up and put it down like a baby right where you want it.
This is the first of the night. Air cab, son.
We're coming low out of the rising sun, and about a mile out, we'll put on the music. It scares the hell out of the slopes. My boys love it.
Smell of napalm in the morning. Smells like victory.
Man, this is better than Disneyland.
Short, and we gotta go up there so you can kill one of our own guys.
You mad, you mad, huh?
They're all dead, stupid.
Who's the commanding officer here?
I hear you.
Ain't you?
He was close. He was real close. I couldn't see him, but I could feel him.
These are all his children, man, as far as you can see.
They think you've come to take him away, and I hope that isn't true.
Could we talk to Colonel Kurtz?
You don't talk to the Colonel. Well, you listen to him.
Are you an assassin? I'm a soldier. You're an errand boy. Sent by grocery clerks. To collect the bill.
Yes, and that was the trailer for Apocalypse Now, and this is our Plato's Cave review of Apocalypse Now. So I'm going to read the synopsis. Okay, in Vietnam in 1970, Captain Willard, played by Martin Sheen, takes on a perilous and increasingly hallucinatory journey upriver to find and terminate Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando. A once promising officer who has reportedly gone completely mad. In the company of a Navy patrol boat filled with street smart kids, a surfing obsessed cavalry officer, and a crazed freelance photographer, Willard travels further and further into the heart of darkness, aka up the stream. So, where shall we start on this? Because before we actually watched the film, I already had a vague idea of the sort of narrative of the movie, right? And I think I told you that it kind of reminded me of Homer's Odyssey.
Yeah.
And on this viewing, I was very I was looking forward to the bits where they meet those Black Panthers who keep on rebuilding the bridge over and over again. I never actually knew that they were rebuilding the bridge over and over again.
As they're leaving. Like every night Charlie blows his bridge up and then they rebuild it again the next morning just so the generals can say the road's open.
Which, having you actually tell me that piece of information really put forward the idea that this really is like a modern-day Homer's Odyssey built up again.
Yeah, we talked about this. We thought it was kind of like that, the story of the guy who rolls the boulder up the hill.
Mm.
What was his name again?
Sisyphus.
Sisyphus, yeah. Sisyphus rolls the boulder up the hill every day, only to watch it roll back down again, and he repeats the same process over and over again for eternity.
Yeah, and taking on this whole entire narrative style of, like, Homer's Odyssey, you can also apply that to, like, Lieutenant Colonel... Kilgore, Lieutenant Colonel Kilmore, sorry, I'm not 100% up to scratch with these names.
Colonel Bill.
Colonel Bill Kilgore.
We'll just call him Colonel Bill.
Let's just call him Colonel Bill, but he was definitely reminded me of like a Cyclops, you know, from the whole entire Homer's Odyssey thing. Yep. And then when you actually get to the Playboy Bunnies, which I remember in my first viewing, I didn't like that scene. It felt very... like unattached, but now what I know about the Australian Defence Force and world militaries and stuff and all these campaigns.
So which scene are you talking about here? Is this the one where the USO show or the
The first time that they actually come into contact and they actually see these women sort of dancing with women, dancing with guns and all that.
Yeah.
I never actually knew how uncomfortable one of those women actually looked actually performing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, wow, that was a very nice touch, actually, to actually show how uncomfortable she was actually performing.
Well, she probably was actually uncomfortable while she was acting.
Then when they actually go up further upstream and Willard actually negotiates, like, a night for his men to hang out with these women, you know, for a couple of barrels of oil and stuff, you actually see that sort of uncomfortable sort of, like, Playboy aesthetic, like, really play through and...
Yeah,
it was a very uncomfortable scene to watch. I found it very uncomfortable.
It was very disturbing, especially because, like, you know, the Playboy Bunnies, they're sitting there talking away, you know, trying to actually connect with these guys as, like, people. But they're just sitting there kind of, like, dressing them up, trying to make these real people look exactly like the posters, you know, pin-up posters they have on their wall.
And they're like, oh, yeah, I've seen terrible stuff of war and all that. And they're just using... like that as a way to pick up, really, and, you know, get there.
It's just R&R. Like.
Yeah. but what really actually, because those scenes are actually really, I felt kind of creeped out by watching them because it felt real. I could actually see that sort of playing out. I'm pretty sure it has played out in sort of ways like that in the world, you know, where a soldier has to eat, you know, so...
Yeah, it kind of made me feel like, you know, what I'd imagine it'd be like going to a really seedy strip club.
And the other thing too that made me feel really, really uncomfortable, and I watched this movie on HD when they finally get to where Colonel Kurtz is hanging out at his compound, I never realised that there was like decapitated heads and stuff on the floor. On the ground.
You never noticed that.
I never noticed that. I knew that there was people hanging from trees and stuff, but I didn't know the actual severity
the
horror of it.
The horror.
Yeah, the horror.
The journalist actually points it out. He says, you see the heads, right? Yeah. Kurt's like, he's a genius, but like sometimes he goes over the top, man. Like he can't help himself, but you know, he's still a great man.
Good like, American accent too, man, I have to admit. So you should go on the acting.
Yeah. Well, howdy.
Yeah, but I knew that... that's what they were always pinpointing, but I never actually knew how crazy Colonel Kurtz was. And then actually sort of noticing that on an HD TV really amplified just how, like I literally feel like I'm crawling out of my skin just like watching some of those scenes. Like it really actually hit me this time around.
And Senior was really like a kind of Cannibal Holocaust sort of esque sort of
but
scenery.
It wasn't like... like it was implied, like that's what he was doing. It was like a book, right? Like a disturbing book.
Yeah.
Like you don't actually see the actions, it's just more described.
And what's really creepy about it is like you have no idea, given no inclination as to why he's doing this at all.
Yeah.
Like he's just randomly killing people, putting their heads everywhere for no reason.
And even though, like, when you finally meet Marlon Brando's character, Colonel Kurtz, and he starts describing all the horrific things he's done and his views on life and all that, the guy's completely off with the fairies. And it's like, none of this makes sense to us, the viewer. Like, it only makes sense to the individual, you know, which is like a bit of another casualty of war, that whole entire fog of war scenario that the movie likes to play on. So,
like on its most recent viewing, I think I started to get a little bit of an inkling of like where Kurtz's mind is going.
So where do you think Kurtz's mind was going?
So, well, we watched that YouTube video. Yep. I did that synopsis, and I think what Kurtz is trying to do is he is trying to escape, find a place in his head that where he can escape judgment and escape the guilt and the horror of what he's done.
Mm.
And so, you know, when he's talking, you know, when he's talking, there's that whole spiel where he's talking about those Nicaraguan Contras who were like, you know, cut off the inoculated arms of the children.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, the strength, the will to do that.
Mm.
And it's kind of like he's colorblind, you know, he's wiped away his kind of vision of good and bad.
There's also like some symbolism where he's always wiping his head with water, like trying to pat it down, like he's trying to clean himself. He's
trying to cleanse himself constantly.
And he's even dressed like a sort of a Mormon missionary, sort of in a way. There's definitely like, I just want to cleanse everything. A lot of talking about, and when you actually do try to get into the mind, like even when he's talking about these horrific atrocities that he's done to kids and he's seen all these terrible things, there seems to be this motif about cleansing himself and getting clean and getting away from it. And
the way he's tried to do that is earlier in the movie, Willard says, you know, the ship piles up so fast in Vietnam, you need wings to stay above it.
Mm.
And Kurtz is trying to get above it. He wants to raise the good and evil dichotomy, and all he sees is strength, purpose, you know, the will to do what has to be done. Except he went up the river, he got to that place, and he found out that there's nothing to be done because this is a completely pointless war he was sent to fight.
I don't know. I kind of thought like the whole entire idea of going up the river, going up the stream. And as the movie sort of artistically symbolises, it gets darker and darker and you start to see more messed up and just men sort of losing their sort of humanity type of thing. It's more like a self-exploration of oneself when they have to give themselves up.
Yeah.
They have to just get rid of all this evil stuff. And I would like to actually watch this movie or hear the opinions, I should say, from someone that's actually suffered, like, from post-traumatic stress, disorder, whatever, because
I think that's one of the things that makes this movie quite remarkable, though, is just how ahead of its time it is in depicting, you know, like, how the effect that conflict has on the men who have to fight it.
Yeah, because you can't go back to normal civilian life once you've seen
the atrocities. Yeah, the Vietnam War was still being fought while this movie was being made. Or it might have been started, I think, just after the end.
Yeah, and I don't know, that I found like another layer of creep, like just another layer of this movie that made me just kind of crawl out of my skin, because you've really got to accept that everyone's a bad person, you know, especially in the situations of war, you know. There's one scene where in the movie, they accidentally shoot some local Vietnamese while they're trying to do some trades for oil, and they just shoot these local civilians, but there's one survivor, and Willard just comes and just shoots him. And then he makes the comment like, oh, this always happens over and over again where we put like a Band-Aid over everything, but we don't actually just finish the job.
Yeah, we tear them to pieces with machine guns and give them a Band-Aid.
Yeah, and it's like, well, you may as well just kill someone, you know. It's the best of two evils, or you're just going to leave someone just disfigured, you know, for the rest of their life, you know, so.
There's a really strong anti-Vietnam kind of war message in this film.
Do you think
film,
it was? Because doing some research into the movie, like one of the producers, I don't think it was Francis Ford Coppola, but they were actually quite pro-military, but seemed like they wanted to make like a warning film, like this is the actual issues of war.
I don't think it was.
So I don't think the movie so much actually is against.
I'm not sure if it was like a anti-war film in general, but definitely had some very strong kind of messages to say about the Vietnam War in particular.
Yeah,
it's I think there's a scene where you know, Willard and the crew, they go up and meet these French guys. Defending their plantation, and the French guy there, who's the leader of the plantation, says it best. He says, "You know, well, when we were here, you know, we fought for something. We fought for this land that we claimed that we felt was ours. Mm. But you Americans, you know, you fight for the biggest nothing there ever was."
And that's what a lot of people actually have trouble with, like sort of vets from the Vietnam War. They can't really comprehend this idea that it was a.
It was just a completely pointless, just futile slaughter, basically.
Yeah, it was.
And it was always going to wind out the same way.
Mm. Yeah, so did you notice any other sort of symbolisms that you'd like to bring up?
I noticed some sort of, I think, symbolism kind of comparing the Vietnam War to, like, American colonialism, especially, like, colonialism in the Old West.
Yeah, okay.
So, there's that scene, you know, before the flight of the Valkyries.
Yes.
You know, when, Captain Willis says, "Oh, you know, this troop, you know, they traded in their, you know, their horses for choppers and went terrorising around Nam, something like that." And you know, there's when they're taking off, you know, you got that guy there. He's in like the Texas Ranger hat with the scarf and everything, you know, blowing a bugle, and that Commander Bill, kind of character, Kilgore, Kilgore. Okay, go get it.
You get it, yeah.
But he actually kind of made me think of like a General Custer kind of character.
Yeah.
Like ranging out in the frontier, just doing whatever he wanted.
Yeah, I didn't get that. You mentioned it, the similarities are bloody striking as well.
And, like the way they attack and, like, the language they use
and
when
the
they're referring to the Vietnamese.
And the yellow turtleneck that he's wearing and his men sort of following. Wow, I did not pick up on that.
Yeah, and there's that scene, there's a scene like, where the chopper's landed and this Vietnamese woman comes up and throws a grenade in and explodes and he starts gunning them down. He's, "Oh, fucking savages." Using that kind of really sort of language, and, like, it's a completely unbalanced fight.
And the other thing too, like Kilgore, like he's one of the most interesting characters they meet going up the stream, you know, the first stop. Because he kind of treats war like a game, like down to the fact where he's like, he's more concerned about surfing, you know, like we'll kill these guys off and then we're going to go for a quick surf. But the other thing was like the death cards.
They
just throws out like, oh, whatever, like a game of 21, you know. And just sort of just showed how detached he was. He was like looking at this movie from a narrative point of view, like these are all steps of how much humanity you have to lead to get up to this level.
To
it's like a video
darkness.
Game in a way,
yeah.
You know, so.
It's, what was I going to say?
Well, it kind of reminds me of Dante's Inferno. In a way, or a Divine Comedy, you know, like it's kind of ludicrous how. Like every step, every layer, you just lose a little bit more of yourself. Mm. And then...
And Kilgore, he sees the war as kind of just like a job almost.
Yeah.
Like a really fun job that he just goes out, tear asses around, you know, shoots people, then heads home, you know, for a bloody steak and some beer at the end of the day.
Yeah. My favourite line in the movie, you know, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning."
Wow.
It's
you did that accent really well.
Of victory.
Smells like victory. I love it.
He's one of my favourite characters. "What do you think of that swell, Sergeant?"
"The 6-foot swells."
"Don't you think it's a little bit hairy?" "No, no. What about the swell?"
Charlie, don't surf.
But my favourite stop-off was just where they meet the Black Panthers with the Sisyphus. I love that.
Yeah, the Dolong Bridge.
That is probably one of my most favourite movie scenes, but I just love the sound effects.
Oh, yeah.
There's that guy screaming.
That really and that creepy carnival music in the background.
It's just now we've just entered the circus.
Yeah.
You know, like how creepy is it?
Like we've crossed the barrier into like the dark realms.
But the other thing
psyche.
Too, like if we're going to use the whole entire Dante's Inferno sort of analogy that I've made, because for me that part of the movie is really rife with the best symbolism because they're going up the stream, they're seeing like American soldiers like jumping in the water, trying to get away from Charlie. But it's almost like in Dante's Inferno.
They're like the souls of the damned, kind of.
Yeah, just stuck in the mud, you know, for all eternity. And it's like, wow, that's so heavy. Though I think this film, it's accurate in its portrayal of the feeling of war. Where if you take a movie like Private Ryan, the aesthetics of that movie are accurate in the actual look of the film. But this movie seems to take a more mental, sort of psychological and spiritual approach to war, if you get what I mean.
Well, that thing, the one thing I wanted to talk about with the kind of overarching sort of theme of the movie is, like, I would call Apocalypse Now a Vietnam War movie.
Yep.
But it's not a Vietnam War story.
No.
Because what you see here is this really timeless story of, you know, men kind of, you know, pushing forward into the wilderness with some kind of vague goal and, you know, having to venture further and further into their own souls along the way. You know, it's this sort of, you know, this almost frontier myth sort of like story.
Well, it's almost like, you know, those movies about self-discovery and they're usually like a happy, you know,
it's
happy
usually
ending.
Happy.
This is a complete opposite.
Apocalypse, it uses the same sort of story,
self-discovery
but subverts it.
Of just how terrible we are as people, you know, like, and I love it. I love it for that choice, you know, just that. Because even, like, going back to my Homer's Odyssey sort of analogy too, like, it even turns that on its head, you know? Like, it's not about the good guys conquering evil. It's about becoming evil and how far you actually trek, you know?
Yeah.
Through the stream, you know?
And I think with that, like American frontier analogy I was also making, there's this kind of allegory that, like, this is the sort of the last psychic frontier like, the American way. Where, like, the American dream comes to die, basically. Mm. You know, it's, you know, exposed to be just as, you know, shallow and kind of, you know, fictitious as it really is.
Mm. What did you...
You know, the biggest nothing... of all time.
What did you think of the character of Willard himself? Even though, like, from the movie-making perspective, he played, like, he was like an observer. And it was even stated by Francis Ford Coppola, he wanted Martin Sheen to act like an observer and just seem, not, like, be shocked at things, but just whatever. Like, this is just how it is, you know? Like, and I don't know. I was thinking about this the other day. Like, I don't know if Willard has actually changed as a character, like, throughout the movie. I think he was always this terrible, like, he was always grappling with that. But I think if we're going on the hero's journey here, like, he doesn't sort of break away from his own sins and stuff until he actually does the final act of killing Colonel Kurtz.
Yeah, he's already broken when he starts the movie. And I think this is where... The Apocalypse Now, like, it plays with the kind of concept of time pretty subtly, you know, in the storyline. Because if you look, you know, the first thing you see when the movie opens, the first thing you hear is, this is the end, you know, that wonderful song by The Doors. And, you know, the jungle exploding, and you see these kind of faint images of what Willard is going to be going towards. And there's this sense throughout the whole movie that, you know, Willard is just kind of going through the motions, like, he's been here before.
Yeah. And even, like, how he talks, you know, like, he's talking like someone in an office, you know, going through the paperwork saying, and here's Colonel Kurtz.
And,
you know, 35 years and he was already in the Secret Armed Forces.
Yeah, and throughout the movie he's always talking in that kind of post-tense narration sort of thing, but you never actually see, you know, normally in a story like that you see after the end of the movie where he's talking from and how he's developed from there. But you don't see that in Apocalypse Now.
No. He's just a complete, he's just the observer in this movie, just going along for the journey. Well, it's his journey though, but he even states in the film he can't talk about his journey without talking about Colonel Kurtz's, you know, journey as well. So,
well, there's one scene I really want to draw attention to with that. So, you know, it's just after Willard's been contacted by those you know, military officers and told he has a mission, and you see him, he's walking towards the officers to get the mission, and he says something like, I was to be, you know, sent up the river, you know, like you know, like a giant kind of electric cable running through NAMM
plugs.
And then he says, plug straight into Kurtz. And what's interesting about that is up until that point in the movie, Kurtz actually hasn't been established. His existence hasn't been established as a character. So, but he says it as if you already know it. Maybe that's just an oversight in editing, or maybe that's
I think that's a really good sort of analogy. Like, just he's just got to plug in, like, just reboot the system, you know? And that, again, like, sort of brings up this idea just like how atrocious and heartless war is, you know? Like, there is no heart. And yeah, no, that's a really good analogy. I didn't get many of the quotes, so I...
The only way to cope with war is to completely erase your normal moral senses.
And you kind of got to be absorbed by it, you know? If we're going back to this idea of, like, post-traumatic, you know, stress syndrome and stuff, probably the best way for a lot of people to get over it is you've just got to be part of it. Just accept it. Acceptance is the only thing you can do when they die. So... Yeah, wow. And
perhaps that's kind of what Willa does at the end of the movie.
Well, yeah, the movie is about him just accepting, you know, how atrocious.
But I'm a little bit confused about the ending of the movie. See, I when I watched my version of the Redux, he doesn't call in the airstrike at the end. He just sails away.
Yeah, I didn't get the airstrike.
But I think is that in, that must be in the original version because
I don't know. I think in the theatrical version of the movie, but we watched the Redux because that's the one that Francis Ford Coppola wanted for normal people to watch, so...
So that's how the Redux ends, but I'm pretty sure the theatrical version, he calls in an airstrike and you see flames shooting up and...
I don't think there was an airstrike. I just thought, like, he just kills everyone and then all the villagers around him sort of bow down and then he's...
Well, he kills Kurtz. He walks through the crowd, gets to the boat, just like he does in the Redux. But in the theatrical, he gets on the radio and says... blow it all up.
Yeah, okay.
He actually gives the guys the coordinates.
Well, there was probably that for the theatrical version just to make the movie seem more cinematic, and I don't really like that.
I guess to give it more closure.
Yeah, but I don't really like that idea because that just seems like a bit of just Hollywood input, you know? it's the last scene in the movie. Just put this in, you know, just to make it all stream over. Well, I just prefer he just gets on these boats and then it's done. Okay, I'm just going to go back to my apartment and punch mirrors all day.
But that plays with my mind, though, because Kurtz, you know, just before he, like, walks out into the crowd, he reads Kurtz's journal and there's scrawled there, you know, drop the bomb, you know, eradicate them all.
Whoa, okay, wow.
That Kurtz has just scrawled in before he died.
Okay, well that's pretty cool because, like, playing from this, like, from a... We're going to go into like a split dimension sort of part of the podcast as well. Like, if you want to look at it that way, it's sort of interesting because it seems like there was like a suicide vow from Kurtz, right? And wow, that would be really quite heavy as well if that was his main intent, just to kill everyone and take everyone with him. Hence, going back to the cult leader sort of scenario, taken to a higher plane, you know, but his higher plane is messed up and brutal and disgusting. So
yeah, the only way to end the horror is just to erase everything.
I can't really say much of it because I didn't actually take much of the quotes and all that as I should have in this movie. I was just more just focused on the whole entire narrative of the story. So it's really hard for me to sort of gauge with this movie because there's so much going on. And
I made a conscious decision to focus more on the quotes this time because that's what I've done the last few times
I've
watched it.
I was more focused on all the points and what do all these points actually mean for actually losing a part of your own humanity. And this is where I kind of get stumped where they meet the French...
the French guys.
French guys and that, and then he meets that widow, that French widow when they have sex and they smoke some opium. And
Don't actually see them have sex.
Yeah, you don't see them have sex, but it's
kind of implied. Yeah.
Yeah, so... And I was sort of wondering, is that... Do you actually think, like, that was a part of losing your humanity? Or was that, like, an attempt for Willard to actually regain some of his humanity before he actually did the final part of his trek?
That's what it kind of felt like for me. Like, it was it's kind of last reaching back to this sort of old world.
Because it seemed like there was definitely a connection between him and this widow. Like, they both lost, you know, had, like, suffered losses and casualties and were part of a war that they didn't really quite understand and all that. And
there's one quote she keeps on repeating. participating, mm-hmm. which is, there's... Well, she was talking about her dead husband, mm. and she said to him, don't you see there's two of you, mm. one who kills and one who loves.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, wow. So definitely there's that symbolism of regaining one's humanity. But do you think by the end of the movie, do you think Willard has regained his humanity, or do you think he's going to be always stuck in the abyss?
I think what he's done by the end of the movie mm. is realize that this supposed humanity is a lie. Mm. And what he's done is kind of surrender himself to mm. that. Because what I think, I'm just talking hot air here.
Let's talk about what Willard would have done after this movie.
Because perhaps like what kept the horror going, what keeps the Heart of Darkness alive mm. is like the struggle of Kurtz to try and control, to regain mm. some kind of sense of humanity, of moral authority.
Mm.
And, through all these, and it just drives him insane. It just mm. drives him, mm. Into the darkness.
Mm.
And perhaps Willard by the end,
mm.
drops the bomb, doesn't drop the bomb.
Yeah.
He kills Kurtz, but then he walks away.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of symbolising him just accepting that, mm. yes, this humanity is a lie. But
yeah, I can imagine like Willard would accept humanity
I'm
as
gonna
a lie.
Find a way to let go and move on.
I'm actually wondering like how would like Willard actually live after the events? So, like say this mm. was a totally real film. And what would he do after like this? Would he just go back to in Saigon and just drink away and eventually commit suicide? Or?
Well, he says multiple times he's never going back to America. Yeah. Like that's not his home anymore.
Mm.
I don't know. I could actually kind of see him perhaps just like moving into the outskirts of Saigon, mm. like getting a Vietnamese wife or something and living like an expat.
Yeah.
Hang around when he's old and
like
short
just
shorts.
Looking at the sort of character development of Willard, because this event, whatever happens in this movie, obviously would have had a toll on him. But I don't know if it would have actually changed his way of living or not. And that's why I find actually, like he says, he will never go back to America. But then one could also argue that he probably would go back to America to face the good demons, the good angels or whatever, he'd have to go back and actually go up the stream again in a metaphorical sense to actually recapture his humanity if he's lost that. I'm sort of like just going on a string here because I'm trying to picture like I find Willard fascinating in that idea where he's just been engulfed by the darkness, but can he ever go back? Or is he just stuck in the darkness forever? So,
well, like what he's trying to find throughout mm. the whole movie, what draws him to Kurt so mm. much is closure.
Mm.
I think what's happened here is like he's been so traumatized, mm. That his vision of what the normal world is, has been completely mm. stripped away. And, mm. He's sort of seen under the curtain saying how absurd this, mm. This facade of, mm. Western society and, normal life is. Mm. And now, when he goes back to Saigon, he's trying to put that curtain back down, mm. but it doesn't quite fit. Where before it was so seamless and so kind of... it looks so much like reality. Now it's jarring mm. to him. It's, doesn't seem to be in place.
Mm.
And so what he's trying to do is get to Kurtz
mm.
to go back to that place mm. to try and figure out
mm.
what went wrong.
Yeah.
And, get some, drop a new curtain.
Mm.
Find something that actually fits.
I want to go back to some of the more style choices in the movie. I've talked about the oversaturation of the oranges and stuff at the beginning of this podcast, and I do wonder if Francis Ford Coppola, when he was going for that saturated orange colour palette or whatever, whether he was trying to say something about war being oversaturated itself,
mm.
especially with journalists within the movie. Like we meet... a journalist at the end of the movie that's just completely lost his nuts, you know, following, you know, Colonel Kurtz. But then we also see journalists at the start of the film before we meet Kilgore, where they're like trying to get Willard just to go, 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 don't look at the camera, you know, like trying to squeeze every little bit of information. It was like as if they were sort of saying, like, knowing about this war, like, knowledge is actually a really destructive. I don't know if there's something, maybe I'm looking too much into this side of things, but I think it's worth sort of pointing out. Because
I think
Vietnam War was probably one of the biggest sort of wars for journalists to get involved. Like, it changed the game. Like, journalists were just getting sent over there and reporting on all sorts of atrocities. And, you know, the onslaught of colour TV and stuff just changed the game. And it brought these sort of atrocities, you know, to a more vibrant sort of colour in our living rooms and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. You have any thoughts on that or...?
Well, as far as, like, the media goes, I think that kind of scene right at the beginning of the movie when they landed with, Colonel Bill.
Mm.
And, you know, there's Francis Ford Coppola with the film crew going,
yeah.
Just go straight past, look like you're fighting, look like you're fighting, don't look at the camera.
And I don't know, I find it so interesting that the film is so oversaturated, and I really do wonder if there was some thought about just the oversaturation of war.
I would say, like, the oversaturation of the orange colours would have been in part an attempt to kind of capture the atmosphere of Vietnam.
Yeah, it was a stylistic choice, definitely.
Yeah.
But I do wonder if you could sort of apply sort of just the oversaturation effect on... Because the other sort of stylistic,
I think it fits with the idea of apocalypse now. And, you know, what do you think of the world looking like if it's about to end? Mm. Like if the sun's, you know, kind of about to burn out, you're going to get this orange sort of.
Because the oversaturation of colours within the movie also goes really well with this idea of fog of war before the fog.
Yeah, there's all this smoke and everywhere, just mist and smoke and every other kind of fog.
The purple haze effect. Love the purple haze effect. which I've. Watching a few video essays of Apocalypse Now, I found that quite a really interesting choice. Like, they have not like sharp edits that you would see with most war movies. Like, most war movies go with really sharp edits. Like, here's Charlie, here's the good guy, cut between the two. This is more about like having fog and then doing like a slow transition across, you know, the sort of bringing this mesmerizing.
Just kind of psychedelic,
you know, fog of war. And I just found that so interesting. Because I remember on my first viewing, I kept on thinking to myself, like, do we really need this much smoke? Like, I know it's war, but there couldn't have been this much smoke. And I doubt that there was that much smoke in the actual Vietnam War, but how this movie actually uses it, as I said, this movie's about invoking the feeling of war, not actually showing what happened in war, which in saying that, I think it also makes it seem like a more real movie for people that have experienced it.
And,
so,
well, if you think about the way that it's told with Willard sort of narrating afterwards, you know, it's how a soldier would remember this. It's like a waking nightmare.
Yeah. And even the way he narrates is very hazy. Like, it's not like, okay, this is what happened. If I was to compare the narration to, like, something like Fight Club is very particular, pinpoint, deep sort of dialogues, but this sort of narration is more about, it seems like the type of thought I would have in an office while I'm having a cup of coffee and I'm looking over like numbers on the screen or whatever. It's just the sort of more fluid, streamy, la-di-da.
And it's really, you know, it's like purposefully messy. Like, there's all these scenes when, you know, Willard's narrating and then there's like the other crew members of the boat just talking complete gibberish in the background.
Yeah,
like,
and lots of gibberish. Well, there was one scene, I think.
And it gets more and more confused and gibberish-like the further up the river you get.
Yeah, and I remember like some of the people were like sitting on the boat just screaming out weird words like, and so, what the hell are you guys smoking?
There's like the surfer character there with his like arrow like through his head and everything in a bandana going.
He was an interesting character in the movie, and I really liked in interviews and stuff where he captures that dog, that puppy, but then you don't see the puppy at the end of the movie. And in interviews where he's talking about his character, he says he actually became the dog. You know, he became obedient, you know, like he surrendered himself to the heart of darkness.
It's kind of like he was the puppy to begin with, though. Like he's just like a surfer the whole way through the story. He's just going with the flow.
Mm.
Like he doesn't care about anything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he did, but it seemed like he was learning himself. But his learning experience was completely different to Willard, where Willard was so just more focused on the job at hand, like a soldier.
Well, he had his eye on the prize, on getting to Kurtz. Whereas
this other guy, he was a surfer, just riding the wave.
Yeah.
What a metaphor.
And he's just embracing the madness the further up the river he goes. Yeah,
collecting like the dog and dropping acid and hearing the sounds. And you know, and he embraced the heart of darkness in a different way, you know. So, and maybe he... Did he survive at the end of the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, Willard, like, walks up, picks him out of the crowd and takes him to the boat and by his hand.
The guy that actually drove the boat...
Because he was, like, dancing around, like, when they were sacrificing a cow for some reason.
For whatever reason, I don't know if you got this, but there was, like, some symbolism too, and I don't think this was intentional, but it's just how I read into it. Because this movie, you could sit here all day and just read into the symbolism and all that. It's one of those sort of movies. I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong reason, which is why this movie is fantastic.
Yeah.
But the guy that actually rides the boat up the stream, he kind of reminds me of like the ferryman. Like, I'm taking you across the river to die. Like, this is how we're going to do it. So
the guy who drives the boat?
Yeah.
Are you talking about the black captain guy?
Yeah, the black captain, yeah. I don't know. I just felt like he just felt like a ferryman. He felt like the guy
that
takes people through limbo, you know, takes people through Dante's Inferno.
And he just had this really kind of, you know, rigid sort of mindset through the whole movie. Like, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, he doesn't participate in any of the madness.
Yeah, doesn't.
Like, he's still a soldier.
Yeah, he was just a limbo sort of. Yeah, wow. So, this is a fantastic movie. Have you got any other things that you need to point out?
There was once, just when before they get to Kurtz,
mm-hmm.
There's this scene when they're kind of going up the river and there's all these guys on, like, canoes
mm-hmm.
that are painted white.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, I distantly remember a scene from Pirates of the Caribbean, I think, when they're, like, going to the end of the world or something. They're trying to go cross over into the realm of the dead and there's all these... people holding candles.
Is this just before they go up to the stream and there's all those people in canoes standing there?
Yeah, there's all these native people when they're, like, painted in white.
Yeah, and it's kind of
like, you know...
I actually don't remember that being painted white because my eye was drawn to the dead guy hanging in the bushes, you know? Like, and I think before the podcast started, I did talk about, like, just noticing all the dead bodies and stuff. Like, I knew they were there, but I didn't know it was that... horrific, you know, so it just, and with those orange saturated colours as well, like it looked like hell. Like it was probably the closest, and if you look at images of hell, like the best descriptions of hell, like they're always painted orange and just scary looking and it's floaty and I don't know, it really just gives me the creeps. Yeah. So.
I think...
But they probably did become Pirates of the Caribbean.
Those guys on the canoe, I'm pretty sure it's Pirates of the Caribbean, but I think they kind of like, they seem to me like they're almost like the ghosts sort of guarding the gates.
Because I had like the gatekeeper.
Yeah,
like,
the realm of madness.
Using that sort of ferryman analogy of death going through, you know, hell, like they seem like the final gatekeepers, you know, and they, even when they go up on the boat, like the canoes seem to like magically just move to one side so Willard can go up the podium to go meet Colonel Kurtz. Yeah.
What was the other? That was the other thing I wanted to talk about.
You want to talk about some writing? No.
I wanted to talk about the scene where Colonel Kurtz is like talking about the slug.
Yes. Okay.
So. I think I kind of got a little bit of the symbolism in that.
Yeah, because this was right at the beginning where they're having the interview. We're just being introduced to the mission at hand, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yes.
And, the general guy puts on the, you know, recording, you know, that they've found of Kurtz. You know, and Kurtz is like, you know, in my nightmare, I am a slug crawling along the edge of a straight razor. and it cuts, but I crawl. And I think I was, we were talking before how like Kurtz is so caught between the, you know, this old kind of moral dichotomy, you know, the good and the bad.
The bad.
You know, this is good, this is evil, and you know, this that was the soldier's mentality that he went into this war with, and that's what you know, he's trying to, you know, get above, you know, he's trying to embrace this sort of higher, you know, evil, I mean, that transcends, primordial evil that transcends it all. And so that, I think that kind of puts that, what he says there in a bit in context, you know, where he, in his nightmare, he's, you know, crawling along this, you know, moral, thin moral sort of knife's edge that's cutting him the whole way.
I always wonder what the sort of symbolism there, and for whatever reason, my mind goes straight to that sort of Nietzsche quote. It's like when you stare at the abyss, you know, like the abyss stares back at you. It's kind of like if you're walking on like a tight rope wire for so long, you know, like very soon you just kind of get used to it, you know.
And like stray too far to one side or the other and you fall off the edge of the rope.
On this, though, if you put too much pressure on it, like you cut yourself. So
But this old moral kind of dichotomy is, you know, it's what's cutting his mind.
Yeah, he's a guy that is like very... it's the ultimate existential crisis if you really think about it. Like he just doesn't know where he fits in, you know, like, and he's prepared to like inoculate people just to...
He can't reconcile, you know, his soldier's beliefs with his mission.
I want to make another sort of observation from that scene, you know, from a filmmaking perspective as well. I found it quite interesting, like, how he actually gets introduced to Kurtz at the beginning of the film and then gets introduced to Kurtz at the end.
Yeah.
I found that in itself was rather reflective as well. Like, here's one side of Colonel Kurtz where we know he's a bad guy, he's done all these bad things and we have to get rid of him. But then when we actually finally meet Kurtz, it's kind of like, in a weird way, I felt like I even sympathised with Colonel Kurtz in some way. And I found that quite a weird way... how the film actually sort of mirrors itself, if I was to put like a mirror slap bang in the middle of the film, so to speak. I don't know, it was just another...
And well, there's that comparison between that, the general at the beginning and Colonel Kurtz, and the question is, you know, which
and that sort of goes
one
back to
is
your,
really sane here?
And that sort of goes back to your, you know, snail on the razor's edge sort of observation that you made, you know, like there's this sort of like tilt between good and evil, you know, that's... always present, this existential crisis.
Yeah, like that general is kind of like what, a bit like what Kurtz was at one point, you know, because he says, you know, oh, every man has a breaking point, you know, there is, but there is good and there is evil, and you know.
All right, I think we should wrap this up very, very shortly. What else have we got? Anything else that we need to point out?
Well, I took down a whole bunch of notes, but...
because this is a film that we could go on all day about.
Yeah, like there is so much here.
But I think...
probably can't mention anything
at the end
of
the day, it is a very... it's a simple film, but it's a simple film done, superbly done, I reckon. Because if I was just to watch this movie as just a regular old person, I'd say, okay, it's just a simple story of a guy has to kill the bad guy. That's what it is.
Yeah.
In essence... however, it's like the little finer details that make this film so, so juicy, you know, especially if you're into philosophy and all those things. You could just sit here all day. It's almost like the equivalent of a Star Wars film for war movies. Like, it's a simple story, but there's just so much stuff going on that you can just
it's like a story,
sink your teeth into.
A story that's been told over and over and over again, but Coppola's done this great job of, like, you know, evolving that story, making something new out of it and applying it to this kind of Vietnam War.
And the film itself, I would actually kind of classify as an art piece, you know? Like, I think it's, I actually think it's probably close to perfect. So that's why, on a philosophical level, I'm going to give this movie an HD. So
I'll definitely give it an HD too.
Yeah, definitely an HD. And even on sheer enjoyment, though this isn't a popcorn flick that I can just pop on all the time, I'm going to give it five. Yeah, I'll give it 5 out of 5 stars. I think it's worthy of that. I think it's a must-watch film.
Yeah, especially if you're a psychonaut.
Yeah. But it's just such a well-crafted film. Like, and I don't think I could watch it over and over again, as I said, but I think once every few years or something, pop it on.
And something you come back to every few years. And
I get a little bit more out of it, you know? So definitely this movie knocks it out of the park.
Highly recommended.
Highly recommended. And I think that wraps up today's episode of Pop Philosophy. You have any final thoughts, mentions?
Just embrace the heart of darkness.
Embrace the heart of darkness, says Jock. I just want to do a few plugs on here. Next month, we will be reviewing Jurassic Park. And we're going to have our first guest in the audience, comedian Doug. Doug is going to join us. And I think he's going to talk about some of his comedy stuff, and we're going to look into the genetic and things about identity, all to do with Jurassic Park.
We're going to talk about dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs!
Dinosaurs!
Dinosaurs! You know what I love about dinosaurs?
What?
Dinosaurs!
There might even be some unicorns too.
Could you, for the listeners out there, just to sort of help this show get along, because I want to start a Patreon page shortly, could you please give us a positive review on Stitcher or iTunes? If you don't like the show, don't leave a review. Go somewhere else and listen to another show. We don't need that negativity around here. But please just give us some positive feedback. Give us a high rating because it really helps with the iTunes analytics. And secondly, follow the Facebook page, Pop Philosophy, and follow my Twitter at Jerno Cook, Cook with a silent E. That's my Twitter handle if you want to get in more personal and talk about the philosophy about my life. And I think that's
it. Yeah, thank you for listening, guys, and come back next month.
Thank you very much, and we're out. Cue music.